You know how in law school you stumble across a legal term that seems so obvious, so vanilla, and then you crack it open and realize it's this whole intricate universe that can decide the fate of a
Oh,
case.
absolutely. Happens all the time.
Well, we've got a perfect example of that for you today, diving deep into patent law with the case of O2 Micro International LTD v. Beyond Innovation Technology Co. This Federal Circuit decision really shines a light on how even a few simple words in a patent claim can become the central battle.
Absolutely. This case is it's a great illustration of the precision that patent drafting demands and just how crucial the courts are in pinning down the legal meaning of that language. We're focusing today on O2 Micro's patents covering DC to AC inverter controllers, the kind that power the backlights in your laptop. The real crux of the issue was the interpretation of the phrase "only if" within one of their patent claims. It sounds straightforward, but as this case shows in patent law, things are rarely that simple.
So O2 Micro, holding the patent, claimed that Beyond Innovation Technology Co., or BITTECH, was infringing with their own controller chips. The specific claim said that certain feedback circuits would operate only if a feedback signal hit a certain level. BITTECH argued that only if wasn't just plain English in this context. It needed a formal legal definition. This disagreement over two little words ended up at the Federal Circuit.
And for you, our listener, especially if you're thinking about patent law, this case offers some really valuable lessons. First, it unpacks the vital process of claim construction, how courts legally define the scope of patent claims.
So important.
Definitely. Second, it delves into how actions during the patent application can limit your ability to claim infringement later on, particularly through the doctrine of equivalence, which is known as prosecution history estoppel. So, yeah, get ready. We're about to dissect this key case, drawing right from the Federal Circuit's opinion and, established patent law principles.
Okay, so let's lay a bit more groundwork. Can you paint a clearer picture of the technology involved here and how this specific dispute, came about?
Certainly. Think about your laptop screen. The battery provides direct current, DC, right? But the backlight needs alternating current, AC. The inverter controller is the component that manages this conversion. O2 Micro's patents covered specific ways these controllers functioned. The key claim had that "only if" condition, stating that certain feedback mechanisms within the controller would only activate if the feedback signal reached a particular threshold. O2 Micro's argument was basically that BITTECH's chips incorporated this precise operational condition.
And BITTECH's pushback was that the legal meaning of only if wasn't obvious, that it needed like a specific definition from the court.
Exactly. They argue that "only if" could have different legal interpretations within the context of the patent claim and the technology, and therefore the court needed to provide a formal construction of that term. This disagreement played out in the district court during the initial trial.
So what happened there? How did the district court handle this question about only if?
Interestingly, the district court took the view that "only if" was just common English and didn't require a specific legal interpretation by the judge. They essentially left it to the jury to decide what that phrase meant when looking at the patent claim and BITTECH's technology.
Wow, that sounds like it could introduce a fair bit of uncertainty. I mean, leaving legal interpretation to the jury.
It does. And did the jury then make a decision on the infringement claims?
They did. The jury found BITTECH liable for patent infringement, both literally meaning BITTECH's chips directly embodied the invention as the jury understood it,
Right.
and under the doctrine of equivalence, meaning even if not identical, BITTECH's technology achieved the same result in substantially the same way. They even found the infringement to be willful.
Wow, willful too.
So the initial verdict was pretty clearly in favor of O2 Micro.
But that wasn't the end of the road, right? That's where the Federal Circuit stepped in.
Exactly. BITTECH appealed. What was the Federal Circuit's issue with the district court's decision?
Precisely. The Federal Circuit took issue with how the district court handled the claim construction, specifically concerning "only if" and also the subsequent finding of infringement under the doctrine of equivalence. Ultimately, the Federal Circuit vacated the jury's verdict and sent the case back down to the district court for further proceedings.
Okay, let's dive into the first big legal takeaway here. The judge's role in claim construction. What was the Federal Circuit's main point?
The Federal Circuit's central message was very clear. Resolving any disputes over the scope and meaning of patent claim language, even seemingly common words like "only if," is the responsibility of the court, not the jury.
Right, the judge.
Yes. They emphasize that defining the legal boundaries of what a patent protects through interpreting the claim language is a question of law that only the judge can decide, period.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, if different juries could interpret the exact same patent claim language in different ways, it would create a very unpredictable patent system, wouldn't it? You'd have no idea what your patent actually covered definitively.
Absolutely. Total chaos.
Yeah.
The Federal Circuit explicitly stated, and this is a crucial point to remember, when parties raise a fundamental dispute over claim scope, courts must resolve it, even for common terms. Their reasoning was that allowing juries to interpret disputed claim terms without clear legal guidance from the judge undermines the essential principles of consistency and predictability that are fundamental to patent law.
Yeah.
Patent holders and potential competitors need a clear understanding of the legal boundaries defined by the patent. You can't have that shifting around based on which jury you get.
So the Federal Circuit is drawing a really firm line between the judge's legal role of defining what the claims legally mean, like the definition.
Mm-hmm, the control.
And the jury's factual role of then determining whether the accused technology actually falls within those judicially defined boundaries.
It's exactly right. Claim construction is about establishing the legal definition, the meets and bounds of what the patented invention covers. Once the court has provided that legal definition, then the jury takes that definition and compares it to the factual evidence presented about the accused product or process to decide if infringement has occurred.
Applying the definition to the facts.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The Federal Circuit felt the district court blurred this really important distinction by essentially punting the legal interpretation of only if entirely to the jury.
All right. That's clear on claim construction.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's move on to the second major legal issue. Prosecution history estoppel and how it affects the doctrine of equivalence. This sounds a bit more intricate.
It can be, yeah, but the core idea is really important to grasp. Let's start with the doctrine of equivalence itself. As we touched on earlier, this doctrine allows a finding of patent infringement, even if the accused product doesn't literally match every single element of the patent claim. If it performs substantially the same function in substantially the same way to achieve substantially the same result, it can still be considered an infringement.
Okay, so it's a way to prevent someone from making really minor, almost cosmetic changes to a patented invention and then claiming, hey, I'm not infringing.
Precisely. Keeps things fair. Now, prosecution history estoppel comes into play during the patent application process, the back and forth with the patent office.
Mm-hmm.
When an inventor applies for a patent, the patent examiner will often raise objections, often based on prior art, existing technologies, or publications that might show the claimed invention isn't new or is obvious.
Standard procedure.
Right. To overcome these objections, the applicant might make changes or amendments to their patent claims, usually narrowing their scope. Prosecution history estoppel basically says that if a patent applicant makes these kinds of amendments for reasons related to getting the patent approved patentability reasons, they might later be prevented or stopped from arguing that the doctrine of equivalence should cover the scope of what they gave up through those amendments.
So if you narrow your claim during the application process to get the patent, you can't later try to broaden it again through the doctrine of equivalence to catch someone else's slightly different product.
Yeah.
You kind of surrendered that territory.
That's the core principle. You surrendered it. In the O2 Micro case, the only if limitation was actually added to O2 Micro's claims specifically to overcome rejections from the patent examiner based on prior art.
Okay, so that wasn't in the original claim.
It seems not.
Yeah.
It appears the examiner felt the original broader claims were too similar to existing technologies. So O2 Micro added only if to distinguish their invention.
Ah, so the inclusion of only if was a key reason why O2 Micro was actually granted the patent in the first place.
Exactly. It was added for patentability.
Yeah.
And this brings us to the Festo presumption, which is a really important legal principle here, stemming from a Supreme Court case.
Right, Festo.
Under Festo, when a patentee amends a claim for reasons of patentability, it creates a legal assumption, a presumption that they have surrendered all equivalence to the amended claim scope. This puts the burden on the patent holder to try and prove otherwise.
Okay, so it's presumed they gave it all up?
Yes, it's presumed. Hmm. They then have to rebut that presumption, for example, by showing that the equivalent in question was unforeseeable at the time of the amendment or had only a very tangential relationship to the reason for the amendment. It's a tough burden.
And in the O2 Micro case, the Federal Circuit determined that O2 Micro hadn't done enough to overcome this Festo presumption regarding that only if limitation. They didn't meet that burden.
That's correct. The Federal Circuit reasoned that because the only if limitation was added to overcome prior art, a clear patentability reason the Festo presumption applied, and O2 Micro hadn't adequately shown why they should still be able to use the doctrine of equivalence for that specific limitation.
Yeah.
As the Federal Circuit concisely put it, and this phrasing is key, amendments to overcome prior art surrender all territory between original and amended claims.
That's a really powerful statement, all territory. Can you give us a quick, simple analogy to really nail this point home? Because estoppel can be tricky.
Sure, let's try this. Imagine an inventor initially claims a metal part in their patent application. The examiner rejects it, saying, hey, metal parts are already well known, this isn't new.
Okay.
So to get the patent, the inventor amends the claim to a steel part. Steel is a specific type of metal. Later, someone else makes a device with an aluminum part that does the exact same thing. Aluminum's metal, but it's not steel.
Right.
Because the claim was narrowed from the broader metal to the specific steel, specifically to get past the prior art rejection, the patent holder likely can't successfully argue that the aluminum part is equivalent and therefore infringes. They gave up the broader category of metal, including aluminum, when they amended to steel to secure the patent.
Okay, that analogy really clarifies how decisions made during the patent application, the prosecution history, can have significant consequences later on, really limiting the scope of patent protection you actually end up with.
Absolutely. It's not just about getting the patent. It's about what you might give up along the way.
So what are the key practical takeaways from this O2 Micro decision, particularly for our listeners who are law students heading into this field?
There are several really important lessons here. First, and this is critical for anyone involved in patent law, whether litigation or prosecution, this case highlights the absolute necessity of thoroughly analyzing the prosecution history of a patent whenever you're looking at a potential infringement situation.
You can't skip that step.
Absolutely not. You can't just look at the final issued claims in isolation. The entire back and forth that occurred during the patent application process, including any arguments made, any amendments that were made, and crucially, the reasons behind them, can have a really significant and lasting impact on the actual scope of patent protection.
Right.
And consequently, the possibility of finding infringement, especially under the doctrine of equivalence. Patent prosecution isn't just about getting the patent granted. It's about carefully crafting a record that preserves your client's intended scope of protection down the line. Sloppy or reactive amendments can really hamstring your enforcement options years later.
So digging deep into that prosecution file wrapper is absolutely essential. What else should students take away from the O2 Micro case?
Secondly, this case really underscores the importance of being proactive in seeking clear claim construction from the court, especially early on in litigation, whenever there is a genuine disagreement about what the claim terms actually mean. Don't wait.
The Markman hearing, right?
Exactly, the Markman hearing. You can't just assume that a seemingly plain meaning will be sufficient, particularly when the opposing party raises a legitimate question about the legal interpretation. Getting a definitive ruling from the judge on the legal meaning of the claims sets the stage for the rest of the case discovery, summary judgment, trial, and helps you avoid the risk of leaving really critical legal interpretations up to a jury, which, as we saw here, can be reversed.
Yeah, get that clarity up front.
Definitely. And for those of you studying for the patent bar, understanding the interplay between claim construction and prosecution history estoppel is absolutely crucial. These concepts are frequently tested.
That sounds like a really good strategic point to keep in mind as a future litigator or prosecutor.
Absolutely. And, you know, finally, O2 Micro just serves as a really powerful reminder that the specific language you use in patent claims and the detailed record of what happened during the patent prosecution are absolutely fundamental in determining the ultimate scope and enforceability of a patent. Every single word, every single amendment, every argument made to the examiner can have significant ramifications down the line. Precision matters.
Okay, so to quickly recap our deep dive into O2 Micro v. Beyond Innovation, we've seen how the Federal Circuit stressed the crucial role of the judge in legally defining patent claim terms, claim construction, even seemingly common ones, when there's a dispute. That's law for the judge. And we've also explored the really significant impact that the history of the patent application, prosecution's history, especially amendments made to overcome prior art, has on the patent holder's ability to argue infringement under the doctrine of equivalence because of prosecution history estoppel.
Exactly. These two principles, the court's essential role in claim construction and the limitations imposed by prosecution history estoppel, are foundational for anyone interested in patent law. whether you're thinking about litigation, transactional work, prosecution, or broader intellectual property strategy. You really need to understand both sides of that coin.
This case really prompts you to think about the ongoing evolution of patent law. Here's a thought to chew on. As technology continues to get more and more complex, and as patent claims inevitably reflect that increasing complexity, how might this further challenge the traditional roles and responsibilities of judges, who are legal experts, and juries, who are finders of fact, in patent litigation? Does the complexity push more towards the judge?
That's a huge question.
Or consider this from the other side. What specific strategies could patent prosecutors adopt during the patent application process to proactively minimize the risk of prosecution history, estoppel severely limiting the future scope of their clients' patents? How can they maybe preserve broader protection while still getting the patent granted?
Those are excellent questions that really highlight the dynamic nature of patent law and the strategic thinking required on both the prosecution and litigation sides. There are definitely ongoing debates about those very issues.
Well, that brings us to the close of this deep dive. Thanks so much for joining us as we unpack this really important, nuanced case.
My pleasure. It's a great teaching case. Until our next deep dive.